Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. I'm Jacob Jarvis. Before we tell you what news to look out for over the next 7 days, first, we'd just like to say a massive thank you to all of you who signed up to support us on Patreon. Advertising money is getting a lot tighter at the moment, and your support really does mean more than ever. If you aren't signed up, for £3 a month, you can get all of our episodes ad-free and early. Search Bunker Patreon Podcast or follow the link in the show notes to find out how. Now, on with today's show, and this Monday, I'm joined by the author of The Future of Trust, Jam Tomorrow host, and Oh God, What Now mainstay, Roz Taylor. Good morning, Roz.
Hello, Jarv.
Roz, so first up, there's been a lot of, among the chattering classes, let's say, gossip about an election being called pretty soon, hasn't there? What do you think to this? And is it potentially actually just some weird way of maintaining party discipline from Sunak?
Possibly. I mean, your guess is as good as mine, to be honest. It's I'm getting pretty tired, to be honest, of hearing election gossip. The more you hear of it, the more frustrated you get that it's not actually being called yet. And Sunak did an interview that was broadcast on Sunday saying that he still wasn't going to give us any indication and we would just have to keep hanging on. And I think people are beginning to feel, why? Why do you keep stringing us along like this? We don't like it. Just give us a date. I think there is a version of events in which Sunak is dangling the possibility of a summer election in order to fend off a leadership challenge. Because, of course, as we will talk about in a moment, the local elections are coming up on Thursday. And depending on how badly the Tories do in those, he might face another challenge. Potentially, she's back from Penny Mordaunt. But who knows? It's all just Tory psychodrama all over again.
Penny Mordaunt and her massive sword coming in to save the day for the Tories. So on the local elections then, what is your overall feeling of how this might go? And please give me a slightly longer answer than just really, really badly for Sunak and the Tories.
There's been an element of downplaying expectations for Labour over the weekend, which is understandable, but may also be accurate because judging by the focus groups in particular that we're seeing, there really isn't a lot of enthusiasm for the Labour Party out there. And what tends to happen when there isn't a lot of enthusiasm for a party is that people vote for parties that they, especially at a local level, that they believe in, but who they know don't have a chance of winning a general election. So we're talking Reform, Greens, things like that. So it may well be that Labour do underperform, certainly when you look at the contrast with the national polls, where they're routinely now 18 to 20 points ahead. Yeah. The expectations are so low now for the Tories that if they do reason, you know, if they do better than expected, that will be portrayed as a massive victory for Sunak, and he will try to spin it as the turning point in which his efforts to revive the economy are beginning to pay off for the electorate. So they are quite crucial elections from that point of view because they will give a sense of the mood music and in particular how much more Labour has to do in order to seal the deal with the electorate.
The amount of turning points that Rishi Sunak claims to have had is quite something. He must be very dizzy from all of them. When it comes to the locations in the local elections that will have the perhaps the most wide political impact, where are you particularly looking? Or is focus maybe more on, say, the mayoral races as the more significant when it comes to what it means for Rishi Sunak and for the Westminster side of politics?
Yeah, the mayoral races are very important because they probably won't be a clean sweep for Labour. They could be, but it's not certain. So the places that are key for Sunak are Birmingham, the West Midlands, where Andy Street is trying to hold on to the mayoralty in the face of a Labour challenge. And of course, the Tees Valley, because that's where Lord Hootchin, Ben Hootchin, is the mayor, and he would very much like to keep his position, despite quite a lot of controversy over the Tees Works development that he was responsible for. So if the Tories can manage to hold on to those, it will actually look like a not bad result, and certainly the Tories will try to spin it as a not bad result for them. Elsewhere, there's Dorset and Gloucester, which are Tory strongholds, and might well fall to the Lib Dems. Again, that's not very useful for Labour. Then there's Bristol. Bristol could possibly turn green. Okay. So there are a number of places which are actually key. But I mean, the number of councillors that the Tories lose is also very important. And I think that would be quite high. East Midlands looks less close than it did. I think Labour will probably get that. I suspect that Sadiq Khan will easily take London, but easily is a relative term because his Tory opponent is frankly an inadequate candidate and has underperformed throughout the campaign. So it would be astonishing if he didn't do well. But there is a lot of combination of anger, discontent and cynicism, I would say, about Sadiq Khan. And I think he will struggle to get the vote out. This is, of course, this will be his third mayoral term. And I don't think that we'll see a kind of full-throated endorsement of Sadiq Khan, which he's hoping for.
Ross, so this week, moving away from the local election side of things, there's also going to be this no confidence vote in Scotland, isn't there, with Humza Yousaf. How does it look like it's going for there? And is he actually just going to quit before it comes down to this?
It does look as if he will quit today. Things are looking very bad for Humza Yousaf. The BBC says this morning a senior SNP source says he's considering quitting. You tend not to do that and then not quit. So I would expect him to do so today, although, of course, anything can happen in politics. He was dependent on the vote of a single ALBA MSP, Ash Regan, who quit the SNP. And ALBA is a nationalist party, of course, that is firmly opposed to many of the SNP's direction of travel. Of course, they share a common yearning for Scottish independence, but they are very different. And the fallout from the disagreement that they had, where Alex Salmond went off and founded ALBA after being very close to the SNP's former leader, Nicola Sturgeon, was very bitter and unpleasant. So it seems that Yousaf may have decided that he just couldn't bear to be in hock to ALBA. There is so much bad blood between them that he couldn't. Plus, there was the problem of even if he survived the two votes of confidence that are being held this week, he could still have trouble passing the legislation that he wants, and he would kind of hang on as a lame duck leader, having trouble getting much done.
So with Yousaf then, Ros, if he does quit, who might be the alternative and what might happen following that?
It looks like John Swinney would be the interim leader. He's an experienced politician in Scotland. After that, it's possible that Kate Forbes might make a comeback. Now, you might remember that she came second in the leadership contest. She is economically seen as very competent, and she was close to Nicola Sturgeon for a while. But she lost out because of essentially something close to a culture war in the SNP. Her Christian beliefs were seen as unacceptable by some in the party, her beliefs on abortion and gay marriage and so on, though she did say that they would not affect the way she governed Scotland. However, with the CAS report on gender transition and Labour clarifying its position on the topic too, it may be that that one aspect of the culture wars is less divisive than it was, and that might be an opportunity for Forbes to come in and take over. But, of course, she would not take the Greens with her. The Greens are very much on the opposite side of the argument and would not take kindly to a Forbes leadership. It could turn quite unpleasant, I think.
On a slight tangent as well with leaders who might quit. So I noticed over the weekend there were these protests in Spain, but insisting that their leader stays on is a suggestion there. So what's happening in Spain at the moment?
Yeah, Pedro Sanchez, the socialist leader, is considering quitting, and he may well do so today. He's been under pressure due to controversy over the business affairs of his wife. He says there's nothing to that, and certainly the allegations are being pushed by the far right, who are in a position to take over in Spain, potentially, if Pedro Sanchez stands down. There were big, big protests, as you say, in Madrid yesterday, trying to persuade Sanchez to stay and saying, no, we don't want the risk of a far-right government. But the socialists have been very hobbled by a deal that they did with Catalan nationalists, and that is essentially beginning to fall apart. So that's a big point of tension, and there's likely to be a lot of excitement in Spain this week as a result.
On political movement that's going on back here in British politics too, what did you make to Poulter's defection over the weekend from the Tories to Labour? And how does this play both for Sunak and for Starmer? Because there's all sorts of talk around whether it was contingent with a deal or something like that, which Starmer and the Labour Party are denying. But how does it look all round for both of those leaders?
I think it was a very useful move for Labour and clearly extremely well-timed just a few days before the local elections. The fact that Poulter is a doctor and has been doing continuing shifts in the NHS is quite a powerful narrative for Labour, which will resonate, despite the fact, of course, that the local elections are not about really health. Voters tend to respect the judgment of NHS doctors, and the fact that very few of them will have heard of Dan Poulter, he's not, you know, the best known or most active MP, it has to be said, will actually help, because it will give the impression that, well, he's not spending much time in Parliament, so maybe he's spending more time in the NHS, and so he knows what he's talking about. I think it's quite damaging for Sunak as a result, though, of course, lots of Tory MPs were playing it down and saying that, you know, he was an entity and I didn't ever see him in Westminster and et cetera, et cetera. So it is a clever move. Now, was there a deal done of some kind? I don't know. But the fact that Poulter is not standing again at the general election helps his credibility, because it suggests that he's not just trying to cling on to his seat.
Yeah. There's likely to be more Rwanda fallout this week as well, isn't there, which is a sentence we've said many a time. What is the latest in terms of the plan actually being implemented by the Home Office now that that legislation has passed through the Commons?
The Home Office reportedly wants to pick up asylum seekers across the UK in the next couple of weeks and detain them in preparation for deportation. And there have even been suggestions that the timetable for Rwanda flights, which was July, might be brought forward to June. Those are very much rumours. But the direction of travel is clear. Sunak wants to give the impression that the Rwanda deportations will definitely happen, that no legal challenges will get in the way. And there has been unhappiness, shall we say, about the, frankly, nakedly political nature of this move, given that it's just a few days, as we keep saying, before the local elections.
Do you expect to see any more clashes over this at this point as well in the next few days in terms of the pushback against it? Obviously, this legislation has passed now, but that doesn't mean it's the end of people wanting to try and stem what the Tories can actually do here, is it?
No, it probably won't be the next few days, because there's a limited window of opportunity for asylum seekers to make their legal challenges. They have approximately 12 days from being told that they're likely to be deported between the date of deportation. And of course, the Home Office will try to make that as short as possible in order to discourage those legal challenges. But there are still a few loopholes, despite the government's best efforts to close them. So under Section 4 of the Act, asylum seekers can appeal for exemptions to deportation because of their individual circumstances. And of course, people will try to do that and say that for their various personal characteristics mean that they mustn't be sent to Rwanda. On a wider level, some people argue that the Act is unconstitutional. Nonetheless, thanks to the interesting system we have here in Britain, something being unconstitutional does not mean it is not law. And there you can see a tension being set up, which conceivably the Supreme Court might want to tackle. And if the Supreme Court wanted to tackle it, it might also want to halt these deportations until it has tackled it. And that, of course, will set up a big fracas with the government. Then there's the fact that the European Court of Human Rights will probably be involved at some point. Asylum seekers will naturally try to take their cases there if they can, if they're turned down in other courts. And in that case, the most likely scenario is that the European Court says it applies something called Section 39 and says you've got to halt the deportation so that we can hear this case fully. Now, would the government do that? I think at the moment, Sunak would not, and he would just pack them off on planes. That, of course, means that we're effectively flouting the convention and puts us in a difficult position internationally. There is something else to bear in mind, which is that calling an election for July would not only take the heat off Sunak when it comes to this issue, because the nature of the campaign would mean that everyone was so focused on the election that Rwanda actually got less attention than it otherwise might. And in that sense, it might actually be advantageous to call an election sooner, which would effectively be writing off the Rwanda policy, because Labour is going to drop it. But Sunak would argue that he had done everything that he could, and maybe he would be content with that.
Gosh, it's really depressing how drawn out the politicking over this has been, isn't it? It's just horrible.
There's another development as well over immigration today, which is that Ireland is annoyed because migrants are crossing from Northern Ireland, which of course is not in the EU, to Ireland. And they are angry about that and they want to send them back. But Britain says they won't take them back unless France takes back the immigrants, the migrants that are coming from France to England in small boats. And although this might seem a bad thing for the government, there are suggestions that actually Sunak is pretty happy about this because it sets up a conflict that, you know, keeps the focus on the unfairness of the EU as he perceives it. So,
yeah,
not edifying.
No. Well, finally, on the domestic side of things as well, there's more Brexit bad news coming in, isn't there? What are the new checks which are going to be implemented this week?
There are new checks coming in which have been postponed for years on what are deemed high-risk goods, so things like fresh meat and plants, things that could pose a biosecurity risk to the UK. And could bring in disease and so on. Not everything would be checked. Everything is going to be checked, but the idea is there are spot checks and those are done at a special processing centre that has been built in Kent. Now, the question is, what happens to lorries that are deemed to not pass these checks? There is actually no mechanism for telling them to go back home. They could go anywhere. So my advice is, if you're offered something that's fallen off the back of a lorry in the next few weeks, I would say no. But this is a serious problem, obviously, because both the hauliers and whistleblowers and so on have been saying there is no mechanism for tracking what happens to these goods. And we may well see, if they're not performed, if it's not done efficiently, big queues at Dover and possibly the spectre of motorway being turned into a lorry park again. Yeah. There is also the possibility of price rises if there are delays to getting continental fresh food here. So yeah, we can look forward to that as well.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So onto world news now. The Trump trial is going into its second week, isn't it? What should we be looking out for there? I mean, I believe Michael Cohen is going to be giving his take on the situation, isn't he?
Yes, for Trump watchers, that should be quite entertaining and also interesting to see how Trump reacts. The second hearing this week is related to the gag order on Stormy Daniels. There is increasing tension between Trump's lawyer and the judge in the case, which a lot of people have been talking about. And it seems to be increasingly difficult for Trump to keep his temper in court. So far, he's managed by Trump's standards to rein it in and not lose it in court, but he is visibly, visibly frustrated. So that, for the watchers of the trial, is worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Also in the US, there's all these campus protests, aren't there, which have been pretty widespread. Do you expect we're going to see them continuing indefinitely?
No, I don't. I think they will ramp up for a while, particularly as the situation in Gaza becomes worse and worse and people become more and more angry about what's going on there. And they may turn more violent, but the natural cycle of things in universities means that with summer exams and term coming to an end, they will probably peter out in the next couple of months. But that doesn't mean that they're not important. And you know, over the weekend, we saw the Green Party presidential candidate, Jill Stein, being arrested. Things are getting uglier. There is particular anger at Columbia University, where the protests started, about the way that the president of the university has handled it in basically allowing the New York Police Department to come onto campus and make arrests. The student newspaper at Columbia wrote a very, very strongly worded editorial in the last few days to Minouche Shafiq, the president there who used to head up the LSE in London. They've said, you made it abundantly clear that your priorities lie with Colombia's image and assets, not with its students. We've witnessed the total annihilation of Colombia as the advertised collegiate beacon of free speech, expression, and the right to protest. And it accuses her of putting the values of a liberal education on trial. So things are not really calming down, and the protests have now spread to 28 universities across the east and west coast of the US and in Texas.
Gosh, yeah, that's very strong words within that. So on the conflict in Gaza itself, which obviously the protests are focused around, I feel like, again, I've asked this question a lot recently, but could a ceasefire actually be close? It feels like there's some movement there.
There is a little bit of movement. Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, has gone to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia to talk to the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas about what can be done. There are suggestions that Hamas might finally release the hostages, which is a red line as far as the Israelis are concerned. But over all this hangs the threat, the very strong threat, of an Israeli invasion of Rafah. And the US has made its position quite clear on this. Biden has been quite strong and saying going into Rafah is too much. That is a red line for us. But Israel says that's part of its plan. So it's extremely hard to say whether it will all turn even worse with an invasion of Rafah, and that potentially will lead to Palestinian refugees going over the border to Egypt and Jordan, which will infuriate those countries. I wouldn't like to say which way it would go at this point.
Well, Roz, thank you for joining me this morning. Appreciate your insight as always.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, thank you as always for tuning in. Remember, you can support us on Patreon for ad-free and early episodes. Search Bunker Patreon Podcast or follow the link in the show notes to find out how. Supporters also get a shout out on this show. And here is Roz with today's.
Thank you so much to Ilse Mogensen, Unknowing1505, and Ted Mulcawley.
I'm Jacob Jarvis. Thank you for listening to The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people, and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
Start Your Week from The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Managing Editor Jacob Jarvis with Roz Taylor. The audio producer was me, Jake Bailey, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.